print is dead. You hear that all the time. And whether you buy it or not, it is true that until 5 years ago or so, The Hollywood Reporter, one of two storied Hollywood trade papers, was on its last legs. But then Janice Min came along. She made a name for herself at Us Weekly, and because of that, her choice as chief creative officer for The Hollywood Reporter did raise some eyebrows. But Min has managed to breathe new life into that magazine, so last summer I headed out to Hollywood to meet her. And we thought, it being the official month of the Oscar and all, that we'd send that uncut version into the ether as a special bonus episode of our Corner Office podcast.
We're expecting you. Won't you have a seat?
Ready to go to work?
Janice Min, good to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
So I'll tell you what, I was in the waiting room flipping through a copy of the magazine, which I will say again, just for the record, I am taking home with me. I know it's a freebie. And there's all kinds of stuff in here that I don't know that I would expect to find in a Hollywood magazine, right? There's, oh my God, what if Hillary Clinton flames out?
Right.
There's the heat index, who's up, who's not. Lester Holt apparently is up.
Yes.
When you got here to remake this magazine, is this what you had in mind?
It's actually exactly what I had in mind. And if you look at the very first issue we did of The Hollywood Reporter, which came out in November of 2010, it is almost identical in terms of the content and the feel of it and the look of it to this. So I was of the mindset at the time when we were doing this that Hollywood was such a strange place in that you had this incredibly visual industry with storytellers. Everyone in the world is fascinated by Hollywood. I remember this was the era when people were watching Entourage on HBO and people were consumed by the Jeff Zucker, Jay Leno, Conan O'Brien fight. People were really interested in peeking behind the curtain of Hollywood. Yet the press that covered Hollywood was nowhere. We wasn't keeping up with that conversation
right there.
At all.
It was nowhere. I mean,
it was
old and fuddy-duddy-ish, right? You had old Variety, you had the old Hollywood Reporter, and it was a little dusty.
Yeah, it was a lot dusty. And, you know, it's no secret the Hollywood Reporter was pretty much, you know, one foot in the grave, the other foot, you know, very closely behind it.
So why did you take this job?
Because good question. Okay, for starters, I wanted to live in Los Angeles. I think Los Angeles is an amazing place. You know, it sounds incredibly superficial to make a weather-based decision about your life.
You know what? You got to own it.
I own it. You know, I had two kids. I have three now. Living in LA seemed like a great idea. But on top of that, but more importantly, I thought, this seems like a doable proposition. It was sort of, as someone, you know, New York City's a media town. There are, you know, too many publications, too many websites. People know everything about editors and who works where. And here, that doesn't exist. And so I felt like I had an outsider's perspective on this industry here, where I could look at it and say, wait, if I were an editor working here, I would be doing this and that. Mm. And how, why, I think people here would love this kind of thing. And so I had the good fortune of having an opportunity with new owners of The Hollywood Reporter and Billboard and Adweek. They pretty much handed me a blank slate. Well, what do you think we should do? And we did it. And I sort of, I distinctly remember this day, you know, the CEO at the time had this idea. He had come from Condé Nast of creating a glossy weekly magazine. No other ideas other than let's make it a glossy weekly magazine. So I got a sample of paper stock that I thought would be nice, you know, in the shape of a magazine. It was all blank, and I just put Post-its in on every page. This is how I would basically program this magazine. These are the kinds of stories it would have. And from that, we built out a prototype in a month. And then from that, 3 months later, we launched a magazine. And so it was very, like, I don't know how to do anything. I don't know how to cook. I don't know how to do so many basic things, but I know how to edit a publication. And so I felt like I just saw what it could be, and I executed it and I was lucky to have great people from New York join me. And I think one of the improbable things that happened here that no one was expecting was that largely the original staff stayed and were just supplemented by people who came with magazine experience out of New York.
Somebody described this magazine to me as the city newspaper
of a small city, right, of Hollywood.
Yes.
Except it's a city that everybody watches.
Yeah, that's I love that. I describe it similarly often. I say it's the high school newspaper of Hollywood. That's the most expensive high school newspaper could ever imagine of Hollywood. Hollywood is an incredibly insular industry, and I think people who work here don't realize just how insular it seems to the outside world. Mm-hmm. Like, it is a club, and you have to break into this club, and they're tough critics. They're hard on people. They like to see other people fail. It's a town of wonderful and critical people.
At what point do you risk becoming part of the inside, right, so that you can't anymore look at it with the objective eye of somebody who's covering?
I mean, I would say
it's been 5 years now, right?
It's been 5 years, and yeah. I'd like to say if you talk to certain editors I work closely with on staff and writers, they know I don't want to say I don't care, but I don't feel like I need to belong in Hollywood in the way that some people want to be liked very much, you know. And I feel like our influence comes because if they know you can't be bought, or if they know that you have a strong news imperative to your organization, you know, then all that negotiation, all that hand-wringing that comes with sometimes when you're doing stories, you know, oh, please don't say that about me because then we won't give you this story later, or, you know, all that sort of horse trading that goes on at publications. Like, if you just end that cycle, you're in such a better place. And when I started here, I remember we were doing this story in the second issue. Kim Masters was doing it. It was about this movie called Burlesque that Screen Gems, which is a division of Sony, was doing. And it had Cher and it had Christina Aguilera.
Oh,
and it was like, you know, the craziest hot...
I missed that one.
Yeah, yes, you did, as did many, many people. And it was the craziest hot mess of a story. And it was my first glimpse into how the trades of Hollywood had really run. The publicist at the time, who represented Amy Pascal, called up, not me, but called up the business
then
side.
Then of Sony, now formerly of Sony.
Formerly of Sony, yeah. Yes. Called up not me, but called up the publisher and then the CEO to complain about the story. Mm-hmm. Can't you kill it? We were an advertiser, this or that. And, you know, and luckily, I have to say, you know, the CEO at the time, who this man, Richard Beckman, he'd come from Condé Nast and he had a very healthy respect for editors. And he said, you handle it the way you want to handle it. And so, you know, I called the publicist and, you know, I said, you will not be surprised by anything in this story. We'll walk you through it so you'll know what's in there, but it's going to be hard and you might not like it. And then, it all ended up fine. They didn't like it, but they weren't surprised. And they continued to advertise, and that was it. But that whole culture of a trade being completely reliant for advertising and its survival on the people they cover was a pretty broken system.
You came from New York, Us Weekly, mm-hmm. the world of celebrity journalism.
Yeah.
This will sound pejorative, I don't mean it to, but in a baser sense.
Yeah, completely. Right? Okay. Absolutely.
Did people look down their noses at you when you got
here? I think people were terrified. They thought, oh my God, this is going to be Us Weekly part two. And, you know, there was a moment in time when I did Us Weekly, which was between 2003 and 2009, and where it really changed the culture of Hollywood and celebrity. And, Us Weekly rose alongside reality television. Yeah. And the whole nature of what constituted a star was different. Paparazzi was absolutely something that changed the landscape of celebrity coverage. And now every website has paparazzi photos. But anyway, it caught on in an enormous way with the mass population. And yes, so I think the natural thing would be to think, well, why wouldn't you replicate that again?
Well, because, I mean, in fairness, you look at the Hollywood Reporter today, the copy I've got in front of me, and there are hints of Us Weekly in there.
In terms of stories, I think in terms of stories that are compelling that people want to read, yes. And I think in terms of selling a story to an audience that they want to read. I always think one of the mistakes editors make is, like, why do you try so hard to make stories or put content out there that you know no one wants to read? You know, I mean, some of it's just readability. Like, just make it, like, part of the experience, part of the reason I want people to still spend money to read something in printed form is because you want the experience of reading something that people curated in a way from start to finish that is entertaining, that makes it feel, makes the experience radically different from reading these same stories online when you can. Most of them you can get online, but they're going to be packaged differently. They're going to feel different. And part of the Hollywood Reporter, you know, people have said to me, like, they love putting it on their on their coffee tables. They feel like it's a badge of honor to get it. You feel like you belong to the industry if you get it. Mm. And I think preserving that feel and an enjoyable process of feeling like every word on every page and every photo matters and was thought about is an important art of doing something in print still.
On that idea of the rise of celebrity journalism, yep, and reality TV and all that stuff that went along with it back in the you know, 10, 15 or so years ago, to what extent do you acknowledge your role in making that happen and all the not necessarily great things that have happened because of it?
Listen, I think Us Weekly was probably the leader of it. You know, I mean, at the time
she says with a slight grimace.
Yeah,
just because this is radio.
Yeah, I think it was. I had worked at People Magazine when I was in my 20s, and I remember at the time I felt like, oh, you know what? I would never read this magazine. It's so like middle America moms, and I, you know, now I have three kids, and of course, yeah, it seems funny that I would say that, but it just seems so momsy and earnest, and but there was a whole shift in culture that was happening at the time when I started to edit Us Weekly, where you felt like, you know, the whole conversation about celebrity has completely changed. And, you know, people call celebrities by their first names. They relate to them in an entirely different way. And when I worked at In Style magazine, you could see the voraciousness of celebrity consumption. They wanted to know not just, I mean, this all seems so basic and obvious now, but, you know, they wanted to know not just what movies they were in, but what they wore. They wanted to buy their shoes. Mm-hmm. They wanted to have the same hair color. And it became sort of a rabid two-way street of celebrities benefiting from that and media capitalizing on that. So I would say Us Weekly definitely led the charge in that. I felt like, you know, when I started Us Weekly, I felt like, let's make a publication that changes the conversation or embraces the new conversation of celebrity in a different way, and concentrated largely in young stars, largely in reality television. We were the first people to ever put The Bachelor on the cover. Oh, wow. You know, I mean, and things that I think now you can fast forward 10 years and say, oh my God, these are the things that have destroyed society. You know, I remember when I left Us Weekly, they did a going away video for me and Kim Kardashian, who was sort of a nobody, was just becoming a somebody. They got her to say on the video, like something funny, like, thanks for making my, can I say this word? Thanks for making my, you know, ASS, you know, a star.
And I would point out, just because I was flipping through it in the waiting room, there is a piece in this magazine.
It all comes full circle.
Here it is. How Butts Stole the Spotlight from Boobs. Yeah. Here we are in Janice Min's newest Hollywood Reporter.
Yeah. But, you know, listen, that I love that story. Merle Ginsburg, our style writer, did that story. And, you know, I had asked her to do it because that's a great sort of cultural story out of Hollywood that... And it's a great,
which is true, right?
It's a great LA story. And you look at, you know, I love the fact in there that in 2004, was one of my favorite facts in that story, that in 2004, the most searched Google terms about one's butt was how to make it smaller. And in 2014, it's how to make it bigger. And so Merle did a really brilliant job of, you know, getting into stats about plastic surgery. It's the fastest growing plastic surgery, what crazy people are doing.
Wait, to make your butt bigger is the fastest growing plastic surgery now?
Yes, fastest growing plastic surgery. And then it's changed the nature of the red carpet, what people wear, how they pose. And we can all thank Kim Kardashian and maybe somewhere way back Us Weekly. You're welcome.
That's right. On behalf of society, thank you. Was it weird for you to go from a magazine that all of us saw at the supermarket checkout line? You were selling, there were a million copies on newsstands. And now here you are with, honestly, a teeny tiny little circulation.
Oh, I mean, at first it sort of killed me. I remember, you know, when you would do a story at Us Weekly, everyone knew about it. It seems so old when I talk like this, but pre-internet, when you could, on a Wednesday morning in 2006 in New York City, every young woman would be reading Us Weekly and be buried in the subway in their magazine. And that just doesn't happen anymore. And so I remember when I started it, the website wasn't big yet for The Hollywood Reporter. And like, I missed that immediate impact of a story, just like, oh, well, no one's seen it. We have to get it out there. How do we get it out there? And you know, our machinery is much, you know, we have a huge website now where we have social media in a huge way now where we have a much bigger and better machinery. But yeah, it's small. But I also think that the whole business of a large circulation print magazine is gone. That those days are over. Like, you're never going to have a large print circulation magazine anymore. So what I like what we've been able to do here is use this special little high school publication we do, and we reach all the right people we want to reach with this print publication, and yet we're able to take their stories and amplify them to the world with through our website. And so, you know, let's say, for example, this Mad Men you have in front of you here, the Mad Men oral history. Great story. Lacey Rose, one of our writers, did it. That story will probably be, you know, we have a 72,000 print circulation. Maybe some of them will get around to reading it. Maybe, you know, half of them will. Online, though, that story...
Oh, it'll be really buzzy. Oh,
yeah, yeah, that story took off. It was. Yeah. It's already been... It took off online. It probably will be read when all is said and done by 3 million people.
Wow.
Yeah. So, and, you know, so that it's... That you'll probably never see a day where we increase the print circulation of The Hollywood Reporter.
How long did it take you to crack the code, to learn how to talk the talk of being out here, both in the music business with Billboard and in Hollywood with The Hollywood Reporter? Or were you already there because of Us Weekly?
I wasn't there, but I was pretty careful about not sounding like I knew things I don't know. And I'm sure people here would say one of the things I would say all the time is, I have no idea what you're talking about. Explain that to me. Like, what does that mean? Who is that? Should I know who that person is? I did this at Us Weekly too. Like, I never watched, I don't watch The Bachelor. I didn't watch The Hills. I don't care about, you know, Joe Millionaire at the time or The Real Housewives, but the ability to sort of just listen as an editor, listen and sort of notice how the conversation is moving about people and say, like, hey, well, as an objective person, as me, I would find that interesting. And part of it is being able to sell stories that you might not necessarily have an interest in to a wider audience. So can I make that Mad Men story, it's sitting in front of you, interesting to people who don't watch Mad Men? I hope so. Maybe not. But there are probably lots of other stories I could position in a way that you would read that you wouldn't necessarily read if it didn't have the right headline or didn't have the right photo or, you know, didn't have the right tweet accompanying it online. So I feel like being an outsider has worked to my advantage, both at Billboard and The Hollywood Reporter, just to sort of step back and, as an outsider who's just generally interested in interesting things and probably has an above average ability to get the horse to drink at the water, to be able to sell interesting stories to the public.
How much is your success here at The Hollywood Reporter, digital and print, tied to the success of Hollywood? Does Hollywood have to have a good year for you to be having a good year?
No, because Hollywood has had, you know, very not good years, including recently. Last year, box office was down, TV ratings are down, even though overall television audience is up, it's just spread out everywhere, probably on too many channels. But one of the other interesting things I observed when I got here was that the story of Hollywood internally was so negative. People, it was a sport to talk about how bad things were in Hollywood, who was screwing up, who was about to lose his or her job. It was a very sort of negative, toxic environment. And there were bad things happening in Hollywood then. There were mass layoffs at the studios. The economic crisis was still going on. But there was also a great story to tell out of Hollywood. There are so many interesting, creative, innovative things that happen when you work in a town of creators. And yes, there are people who are obsessed with money here, but it's different, I think, from living in New York. And I noticed this right away in New York, the Wall Street factor in New York. You have a whole community of people whose one goal in life is to make money. In Hollywood, you have a whole group of people whose goal in life is to make money, but along the way, they'd like to be critically acclaimed. They'd like to be thought of as smart people, intelligent people, funny. They want to create something that they're proud of and on their way to making that money. Nobody here deliberately does stupid things, puts out a bad movie. Like, everyone actually believes in it. And I think the level of work you put into a project here, that was the other thing that really sort of almost touched me here. The level of work you have to put into a movie or television show, and you have basically one day where it's decided if you failed or succeeded, whether it's at the box office or in television ratings. It's almost heartbreaking, and you sort of understand why people sometimes behave the way they do here, because there's so much on the line with every project that you put out there. And anyway, one of the ideas that drove The Hollywood Reporter was, this is an amazing community of people. Let's cover them. Let's cover them like they are the stars of their own story, you know, and that's how you could say. I remember one of the first covers we did was of Glee, which was a big hit show at the time. And on that cover, we had Dana Walden and Gary Numan, who run 20th Television, which was a studio behind Glee. And of course, now they run Fox, the network, and have had enormous success with Empire. But that was a chance to really show the stars behind the scenes that make Hollywood run. And I'm not going to lie. I think the ability for an executive in this town to be showcased in a way that highlights their achievement, be photographed beautifully, there is an intoxicating effect of that.
This is one of those questions that I'm going to ask where I already know the answer. You don't miss New York at all, do you?
I miss walking. I miss walking. But
that environment, right? The media environment back there, do you miss that at all?
It's interesting. We've had a very optimistic almost 5 years here now. And when you're in the media environment in New York, it feels negative. There is almost a group talk of how badly publishing's doing, how grim it is, layoffs. And so I feel lucky to be here and have been in something filled with optimism, I would say, and having been successful. And like, I can't even tell you how rare it is to be given the sort of license I was handed to do something completely different. That just doesn't happen. And publishing is not unlike Hollywood in that it's risk averse because you have to lay out a lot of money on a bet, and most people don't want to take that risk. So this worked out.
With full acknowledgement that your bosses will eventually hear or read a transcript of this interview, it's been 5 years.
Yeah.
You've turned it around. You're having great success. Now what?
Well, so this is, I will use the biggest cliche that is used in media now.
Go ahead, and then I'll press you on it, but go ahead.
We would like our content to live on all platforms. Have you heard that before?
Yeah, just a couple of times. Yeah.
So listen, I think our digital success has been, we just got our February Comscore numbers, which we sort of live and die by on our Comscore numbers. And we are now, it was our biggest month ever for The Hollywood Reporter, our biggest month ever for Billboard. I'll be curious to see where this all goes. I know the conversation in media is, it's just pennies on the dollar, though, compared to used to get. So where does it all go? And that's a conversation we have actively all the time here. We have, we have video that we do. We have roundtables that air on television. I have a little LA local Emmy sitting there on my desk that we won for one of our shows. So I believe the feeling of content that we have produced for both a print publication and for online can be translated into all sorts of different areas. I mean, we actually had a conversation here the other day. Why don't we have podcasts? Do we have a podcast strategy? No, we don't. Let's have a podcast strategy. I mean, some of it is just Wild West stuff.
Sounds
for us.
A little bit like you're building an empire.
I don't know if I'm building an empire, but I think that what we do with The Hollywood Reporter and Billboard is something special in that we have access to these worlds and credibility in these worlds that are very, very hard to penetrate. And I can't say we can get access to anyone or anybody, but 8 times out of 10 we can. And that's an incredibly valuable thing to just be able to not be the people that most people in media are with their nose pressed against the glass, but the people inside the glass who also at the same time.
Careful, because now you're walking down that I've been captured by my subjects.
Yes, and not to be co-opted at the same time. And I think we can point to a lot of hard stories we've done at The Hollywood Reporter where we can have a huge impact and still walk away, maybe not at the end of the day, but eventually, on the right side with people.
So just to be clear, if Graydon Carter calls and says, hey, listen, Janice, I don't want to do Vanity Fair anymore. You want a job? What are you going to say?
I think I would say I really enjoy living in Los Angeles, and I think this is pretty great. And to be working at something ascendant in media is fun. There are times that it really strikes me. It's a sort of a once in a lifetime opportunity, and I think a lot of people in media, you go from job to job, and you hope one of them is fun and you hope one of them sort of strikes. And I'd like to think for the people who work here on the staff, they work incredibly hard, and that it's also been a very fun ride that you will not, maybe you'll be lucky and get to have that ride again somewhere else, but maybe you won't. So I always impress on people here, like, this is really sort of special.
Janice Min, thanks very much.
Thank you very much. Thanks for coming by.
Welcome to Hollywood, baby.
Let's not even talk about it.
Let's do it.
Let's go.
That is our full conversation with Janice Min of The Hollywood Reporter. Again, this is a special bonus episode of the podcast this month. A brand new one is up as well.
We toured American Apparel with CEO Paula Schneider, who took over for Dove Charney after a whole lot of trouble. You can find that one on our Corner Office podcast as well. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Thanks a bunch. You're blinded by the action. You need that.
He spots me in the lobby of my high rise. I hide behind my shades, cause the fame is blinding my eyes. My God, I know how Ozzy Eyes must have felt when he was eyes high. As I have got to make this.
This is APM.